Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Our lead reports this morning come from Mosier, Oregon, the site of an oil train derailment that forced the evacuation of dozens of citizens from their homes over the weekend. They were able to return on Sunday. We'll hear reports from Amelia Templeton and Emily Schwing. Also in this edition, we'll hear about Coast Guard ice cutter Healy. It left Pier 39 this week for winter on the Arctic Ocean. In the second half of the program, we'll hear about the bizarre and disturbing list of problems with animal testing at OHSU. It was revealed from documents acquired under the Freedom of Information Act. This is The Bridge for the week of June 19th. Last Friday, 14 oil tank cars derailed in the scenic Columbia River Gorge. Four caught fire. Officials said a light sheen of oil was observed about 6 feet offshore in the Columbia at the mouth of Rock Creek. Responders deployed about 1,000 feet of containment boom. The Transportation Department worked operations Saturday to remove rail cars from the site. They had to wait for the cars to cool before transferring the remaining oil from the rail cars to tank trucks. Over 100 residents of Mosier, about one quarter of the population, was evacuated from their homes over the weekend and allowed to return Sunday night. Sunday afternoon, the city of Mosier held an emergency meeting and passed a motion objecting to Union Pacific's plans to restart train traffic while derailed oil cars, many still full of oil, were sitting just feet away from the tracks in severely damaged condition. The city is counting on Union Pacific, as well as Governor Kate Brown and Oregon's congressional district, to remove all oil from derailed cars prior to starting any train traffic in light of the risk of igniting the damaged oil train cars, and complete the investigation determining what went wrong and have it fixed before any oil train or other high-risk train traffic resumes. Correspondent Amelia Templeton spoke to the fire chief of Mosier. Chief Jim Appleton has changed his views about oil transport, at least in his community.
The oil train was on the Union Pacific tracks on its way to Tacoma, Washington, when it derailed. Jim Appleton, the fire chief in Mosier, says in the past he's tried to reassure his town that the Union Pacific Railroad has a great safety record. Now, he no longer believes shipping oil by rail is safe.
It happened in our town, and I hope that this becomes a death knell for this mode of shipping this cargo. I think it's insane.
Appleton says the train cars were glowing white hot, and the heat made it impossible to spray firefighting foam on the burning cars for about 10 hours. If the wind had been blowing, he says, the fire could have spread to the rest of the train. Federal regulators say oil from the Bakken region is more flammable than traditional crude. I'm Amelia Templeton, reporting.
Among the many who share concern about last week's train derailment and oil spill in the Columbia River Gorge is the Native American community. As correspondent Emily Schwing reports, their response is easy to overlook.
A press briefing midday Saturday included spokespeople from the Union Pacific Railroad Company, officials with various environmental agencies from both Oregon and Washington, the county sheriff, and even Richard Franklin, a federal-level official with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Yesterday afternoon, we mobilized to assist and work in unified command with our federal, state, and local brethren.
But the press did not hear from anyone that could speak to the concerns of the Native American tribes and nations that call the Columbia River Gorge home. David Byers with Washington State's Department of Ecology says responders are accommodating tribal resource concerns.
They've expressed concern about the species that might be impacted by the oil in the water and have been giving us advice as to how to implement our geographic response strategies to protect those resources. So they have been actively involved. Even though they're not here now, they have been involved.
Meanwhile, a different scene ramped up a few miles downriver. Lana Jack, who grew up in Celilo Village, 30 miles up the Columbia River, was among the 100 or so citizens that gathered for an anti-oil train rally in Hood River.
So our connection to this river is huge. It's our lifeline. There's probably no really other way of putting it, whether it be the salmon or all that the water provides.
Jack says she does feel disempowered. Even so, as Saturday's hot sun beat down on her, she proudly beat her handmade elk skin drum at the rally. The train derailment happened at the start of a weekend during which tribal members are gathering to commemorate the signing of an 1855 treaty between the U.S. government and 14 bands that make up the Yakima Nation. Elizabeth Sanchi is the nation's environmental manager.
I speak for those things that can't speak for themselves, our fisheries, our water, our land, our air, and we're at risk right now. And it is very disheartening.
Sanchi does say the Yakima Nation has been included in the Unified Command Model response to the train derailment. She says cleanup of any spilled oil must be immediate. In Hood River, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
A new report from Washington State finds an oil tanker grounding on the Columbia River could cost more than $170 million in damages. The report looks at possible accident scenarios linked to the proposed oil terminal at the Port of Vancouver. The report found an oil tanker could spill 8 million gallons of Bakken crude oil. A train derailment could spill nearly 850,000 gallons of crude. The Vancouver Oil Terminal would be the largest of its type in the country. It would move crude oil by ships to West Coast ports. The report found the worst place for a train derailment would be above Bonneville Dam. That's because the turbines would mix the crude oil into the river, killing more fish and wildlife. The damage to recreational fisheries could be in the tens of millions of dollars. The backers of the oil terminal said in a statement that it wasn't appropriate to comment on a report they hadn't reviewed, noting it was one of the many being filed with the state as part of the permitting process. The crew of the Coast Guard cutter Healy left this week from its home port at Pier 36 for a four-month deployment to the Arctic Ocean to carry out scientific research. The Healy crew will primarily conduct three missions focusing on the biology, chemistry, geology, and physics of the Arctic Oceans and its ecosystems, as well as perform multi-beam sonar mapping of the extended continental shelf. For the first mission, the crew will work with 46 researchers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the University of Alaska at Anchorage. The mission will employ the remotely operated vehicle Global Explorer, net trawls, bottom cores, and conductivity, temperature, and depth casts to assess the biological diversity of the Chukchi Sea. The team of scientists will use cutting-edge technology to identify and document the species living in this poorly understood and rapidly changing region. The crew will also deploy an array of acoustic bottom moorings in support of researchers from Scripps Institute of Oceanography and the Office of Naval Research. The moorings will collect data on how climate change and decreased ice coverage is affecting the Arctic Ocean. The final mission is funded by NOAA in support of the State Department and the White House Office of Science and Technology. Researchers from the University of New Hampshire will use multi-beam sonar mapping and bottom dredging in the Bering Sea and Arctic Ocean to further support the demarcation of the ECS. This is the 10th ECS cruise for Healy and the 8th carried out in cooperation with the Canadian Hydrographic Service. This work will directly support the United States' claim for natural resources found on or beneath the ocean floor. The Healy is the nation's newest and largest high-latitude icebreaker. The cutter is 420 feet long and has extensive scientific capabilities. The cutter has a permanent crew of 87 and is capable of other operations such as search and rescue, ship escort, environmental protection, and the environmental of laws and treaties in the polar regions. June is Orca Awareness Month. This is a time when conservation groups recognize the threat that killer whales face. A clan of orcas in the Northwest, called the Southern Resident Killer Whales, have been on the endangered species list since 2005. Many of the whales are found in Washington's inland waters during the summer, although Orca Network co-founder Howard Garrett says the whales make their way south, feeding off Oregon's coasts.
The southern residents will typically go well into Oregon down the coastline. It's not a predictable migration, so they kind of range at will. Basically, we assume wherever they are finding some Chinook.
Garrett says the orca pods eat Chinook at the mouth of the Klamath River and sometimes travel as far south as the Sacramento River in California. In the late 1990s, the southern resident orca population decreased by 20%. After that, they were placed on the endangered species list. Researchers found the whales were undernourished because of dwindling Chinook salmon populations. Garrett says the orca network wants to protect salmon in order to help protect the whales.
Our efforts are primarily to contribute to salmon restoration and the awareness of that linkage between the Chinook salmon and the health of the southern residents. So that's a lot of what Orca Awareness Month will do.
The Orca Network wants four dams on the Lower Snake River removed. Garrett says the dams are preventing salmon from reaching the Pacific Ocean, where killer whales can feed on them. We know veganism is a popular cuisine choice among people in the Northwest. Researchers have been trying to get trout to go vegan for decades because it would be the cheapest way to feed farm fish. Scientists met to talk about it this week in Sun Valley, Idaho. Correspondent Emily Schwing has more.
They're billed as vegan rainbow trout, but their new menu, developed by the University of Idaho's Director of Aquaculture Research, Ron Hardy, includes a little fish oil. So more accurately, you might call these fish pescatarians.
I guess you're right. That would be more accurate. But that's the only animal or fish product in the diets these days.
Wild trout eat insects, shrimp, and smaller fish. So traditionally, farmed fish are fed a meal made from other fish. But Hardy says that's not sustainable.
Aquaculture has grown rapidly over the last 25 years. And if we look to the future, at today's per capita fish intake around the world, we would need to double aquaculture production.
So he's selectively breeding trout that can handle feed made from wheat, corn, and soybeans. So far, they still need omega-3 fatty acids, hence the added fish oil. When the project began, it took nearly a year to produce a one-pound trout. These days, the experiment yields trout that grow between 2 and 4 times as fast in the same amount of time. I'm Emily Schwing, reporting.
Well, it isn't a vegan solution, but maybe the salmon could eat the mosquitoes. Test results detected West Nile virus in mosquitoes from Yakima County for the first time this year. Health officials from the Department of Health are advising people to take action to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes and to reduce areas where mosquitoes can breed. During last year's mosquito season, 24 people in Washington were reported with West Nile virus disease, and one person died as a result of their infection. Last year's season represented the most cases reported since 2009. The majority of people infected with West Nile virus do not get sick. About 1 in 5 people will develop a fever or other symptoms that go away without getting medical treatment. However, for a small number of people, the disease can be very serious and lead to permanent neurological effects or death. People over the age of 60 are at increased risk for severe disease, and so are people with certain medical conditions, such as cancer, diabetes, hypertension, and kidney disease. For over a decade, Washington State Department of Health and Agriculture, local public health agencies, and mosquito control districts have been monitoring mosquitoes, birds, horses, and people to find out more about the spread of West Nile virus in the state. This long-term monitoring shows the virus is likely to remain in Washington in the south central area. While West Nile virus occurs across the United States, other mosquito-borne diseases, such as chikungunya, dengue, and Zika, are spread by mosquitoes not found in Washington. These diseases occur in more tropical climates, including some southeastern states and many places outside the U.S. Reducing mosquito habitats and preventing mosquito bites are the best way to avoid West Nile virus infection. Reduce the number of mosquitoes around your home by emptying standing water from flower pots, gutters, buckets, pool covers, pet water dishes, discarded tires, and bird baths on a regular basis. Thanks to a warm spring, the Northwest cherry season is off to a hot start. A record number of cherries were shipped last month, more than 651,000 20-pound boxes. That's according to the Northwest Cherry Growers, which represents 2,500 growers in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, and Montana. The earliest cherries were shipped on May 20th, much earlier than in past years. 5 years ago, the first cherries weren't shipped until June 15th. The growers' organization predicts about 18.4 million boxes will be shipped during this year's harvest, with a little more than half of that coming this month. Despite the early start, the total harvest is expected to be a little less than last year's, due in part to problems with the Bing variety. As grocery stores and farmers' markets stock the fresh cherry crop that Washington's so famous for, one organization is focused on the people who pick the cherries and their need for safe living conditions. The Office of Rural and Farm Worker Housing in Yakima has developed more than 1,400 housing units serving nearly 7,000 farm workers and their families. Marty Miller heads the ORFH and says most of these workers are not migrants.
Roughly 70 to 75% of the farm worker population are year-round residents of their communities. They live there and work there, and their kids go to school there.
Miller says his organization builds community-based housing so that workers have nearby access to services. The ORFH has focused some of its development in the central Washington town of Mattawa, which has sprouted up as a community for local farm workers. The organization gathers both public and private money to fund the housing projects. Miller says Washington has one of the largest populations of agricultural workers in the country, and some still face dilapidated housing conditions. However, he says the state has done a lot in the past two decades to protect these workers, who often make wages well below the poverty line.
In the state of Washington now, the Department of Health has to annually license any seasonal farm worker housing to make sure it meets a minimum standard.
Emotions have run high this election cycle over the issue of immigration. Miller says his group's housing projects occasionally get pushback from local communities that fear too many seasonal workers are coming into their neighborhoods.
So it's our job to try to address those fears and say, well, no, you know, actually these are families who already live here and they're just in poor conditions. And so we're trying to do this work to improve the communities and give people a shot at a better, healthier living environment.
Farm labor plays a vital role in the state's agricultural economy, which was valued at more than $10 billion in 2013, according to the USDA. You're listening to The Bridge. OHSU has released the list of problems it's experienced in its animal research centers over the last 16 months. The problems range from the disturbing, such as a monkey bleeding to death after pulling out its shunt, to the bizarre, another monkey drinking so much alcohol it passed out. Christian Fodenwenzel has more.
OHSU's Primate Centre in Beaverton has about 5,000 monkeys. At any one time, about 120 experiments are being conducted, from developing a vaccine for hepatitis B to learning why some people handle HIV infections better than others. A Freedom of Information request from the group Stop Animal Exploitation Now has found that there's been 9 serious problems at the centre in the last 16 months. Centre Director Nancy Haywood provided OPB with the documents before sending them to the animal rights group.
What we've begun to realize is that the general public probably doesn't have a good understanding of why we do this research in monkeys.
The problems vary in severity, from 2 mice dying after being injected with the wrong solution to monkeys on restricted diets having miscarriages. In one experiment on alcoholic relapse, a monkey that hadn't been allowed alcohol for 28 days got drunk.
And it basically overdosed. It drank too much and passed out in the cage, was found, reported to the veterinary staff, and resuscitated.
Haywood says the overdose was reported to OHSU's Internal Oversight Committee, which worked with researchers to make sure it doesn't happen again. The university says this experiment and others like it aim to unravel the complex biological factors involved in alcohol addiction. Michael Budke with Stop Animal Exploitation Now ridiculed the experiment. He says according to the National Institutes of Health, OHSU gets more than $5 million a year to do alcohol studies on primates.
I'm very offended by the fact that our federal government is currently using that much money just at OHSU, let alone all of the other laboratories, to perform drug addiction experiments on animals, when we have treatment programs for human beings at work that are not receiving adequate funding.
The university says it only uses animals when other research methods are scientifically inadequate or too dangerous for human participants. Still, Budke says he's going to file a complaint. He wants to shut the primate center down completely.
If research facilities are so inept that they cannot follow basic procedures and are accidentally killing animals during experiments, what does that say about the ability of these facilities to perform research that actually has any scientific relevance?
Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture confirmed that it is investigating the treatment of research monkeys at OHSU. The feds wouldn't say why, but over the last 2 years, the center's been warned about monkeys being burned by heating pads and dying from respiratory distress and fights. OHSU entered into an animal welfare settlement with the USDA 4 years ago. Last month, it got a warning letter. Center Director Nancy Haywood says sometimes people make mistakes.
They happen for the same reason that mistakes happen in a hospital.
A recent study found medical mistakes to be the third leading cause of death in the nation. Of course, in a hospital, patients can sue for damages. Research animals have the feds, who visit the primate center about twice a year unannounced. They can issue warnings and levy fines, but those are tiny compared to the sums being spent on research. But the primate center's attending veterinarian, Gregory Timmel, says they do everything to make the animals as comfortable as possible.
We know these animals, and they have different personalities, and they have different likes and dislikes, just like we do, or just like our pets do. And we take that very seriously, and occasionally when something doesn't go right, we're devastated by that.
The law states research animals are not allowed to feel pain. They must be given analgesics. Members of the public may ask to tour the primate center, but OHSU can deny access. Christian Foden-Wenzel, OPB News.
In our final report this morning, researchers from the University of Washington are studying a drug that could extend the lives of dogs and maybe one day humans. They believe the drug rapamycin, typically used to counteract rejection in organ transplant patients, could be used at low doses to slow the aging process in canines by attacking cancer and other age-related causes of death collectively instead of individually. Matt Kaeberlein, who heads the research, says some scientists still doubt the drug's anti-aging properties.
What we know from the basic biology of aging research is that rapamycin slows aging in every organism where it's been tested. And that goes from yeast to C. elegans, which is a nematode worm, to fruit flies, to mice.
Kaeberlein says rapamycin works on a molecular level, although exactly how it works is still unclear. The lab has completed an initial round of tests and found no major side effects for dogs. The study is hoping to prove that if rapamycin can extend the lives of humans' best friends, it might do the same for the humans. Kaeberlein and his colleague Daniel Promislow are recruiting middle-aged dogs for a long-term study of rapamycin for phase two of the dog aging project. Kaeberlein says the study of the generic drug is facing funding challenges, partly because it doesn't have the backing of large pharmaceutical companies.
It's my impression that if we had a company and we were trying to develop this drug for something we could sell, it would actually be easier to get it funded than working with a generic drug and trying to do this on the basic academic research side.
Rapamycin still has a long way to go before it can be called the wonder drug. As well as studying its effectiveness, there are some side effects seen in mice, such as the development of cataracts that Kaeberlein says his team will be looking out for as they approach phase two. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We love hearing from you. Send your questions or comments to News 1, that's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1, to KMUN.org. Please include The Bridge in the subject line. You can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister saying thank you for listening. And join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.